Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. We are kicking off today's show by talking about the fires that continue to rage in Sonoma County. The Kincade fires have been burning since last Wednesday, and they have charred over 66,000 acres. Because of very strong winds, actually hurricane-like winds yesterday, the fire is only 5% contained. That is down from 10% containment yesterday. 96 structures, including 40 homes, have been destroyed. More than 79,000 structures remain threatened. The PG&E power outages have affected more than 1.3 million people. And joining us to discuss the latest is Rebecca Smith, an award-winning national energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We had Rebecca on recently to talk about a lengthy investigation looking at PG&E's business practices. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. Well, thank you for joining us. I want to ask you a pretty big question to start off with, and we're going to do a panel on this, which we would love to have you join in the coming weeks. A lot of people, my entire family is up in Sonoma County, they're asking, why is this so much worse than it was? Because in the past, we would have fires, but I mean, they were horrible, but there's been nothing like this before. And like I said, it's a big question, but how do you answer that? How did we get to this place?
I think it's a combination of factors. We've seen a confluence of a utility that neglected its distribution and transmission system. And we're also seeing, of course, the climate change, the impact of climate change where, you know, as you know, California has more than 100 million dead trees, right, and millions that are dying. And, of course, brush is everywhere. So it's, you know, it's tinder dry conditions and malfunctioning equipment. And also, of course, as we saw in the last couple of days, enormous winds. I mean, tremendous winds.
So let's first talk about PG&E. There are some updates. People may not get their power back between wind events. Some people might, but according to the latest reports, PG&E said in a news release that some people might be out of power for the entire week.
I think that's probably really likely, and I'm without power where I live in Marin County as well. I think that, you know, PG&E, Andy Deasy, the president of the utility, said last night that they had about 6,000 workers out that would be starting to restore power as soon as they had daylight. So they're doing that now. But with this next wind event coming in tomorrow, there's no way that they're going to get all of these homes back on.
Right. And when it comes to the damage that this does, Rebecca, I'm sorry, I was listening to a number of radio shows yesterday, and a lot of city council members were on saying, you know, this is really affecting small businesses. In fact, one city council member said that in rural Sonoma County, she's afraid that some businesses are going to go out of business because now is a very busy time for the wine country. A lot of tourists come to the area, and this is going to hit a lot of people very hard.
It's a tremendous blow to small business. And, of course, most of us remember 2 years ago when the wineries suffered a lot of loss of their grape crop, where they were right at harvest time like now, and there was, remember, smoke damage to their grapes. It's just a terrible loss for them.
Right. So what are you hearing from officials? How are they going to deal with all of this loss?
I think that, you know, they'll go after the utility for what money they can get from them, but how much is that likely to be for a company that's in bankruptcy? I don't think there's going to be much money flowing their direction. I mean, there was, remember after the last event, they said they'd give homes $100 and small businesses $200. But, of course, that's not enough to compensate. Hopefully, some people have insurance that will cover them. But, of course, we're hearing a lot of people don't.
Wow.
You know, that this is considered to be a weather event and they're not covered.
And you have been covering PG&E for a long time. What do you make of the latest news that's coming out? I'm just reading from MarketWatch here that shares of PG&E are plummeting to their lowest levels yet after Citigroup is warning that the latest wildfire could render them worthless. And let me just look up the stock price right now. It's about four bucks a share.
So I think that the Kincade fire really throws a monkey wrench into the whole bankruptcy process. Right now there are two plans of reorganization, competing plans that are moving forward. One is the companies and the other is one that's been put forward by big bondholders. I think that the financial guys, the hedge funds, the private equity have some real losses coming their way. Bonds are down today and the stock is down, and that's hard for them. I'm not sure that the current bankruptcy proposals are workable if there's a major loss that comes out of the Kincade fire.
Hmm.
And, you know, we're not anywhere near, as you pointed out, 5% contained.
Right.
With more wind coming tomorrow. Wow. There's a real threat from that.
Officials say they might not get a real handle on this until November 7th.
That's just astonishing. And keep in mind that Cal Fire is so much better at fighting these fires now than it was a few years ago. You know, they put their equipment out where they think they're going to need it. They've got teams all over ready to, you know, jump on embers or sparks that come down somewhere. Wow. I think that really PG&E's fate sort of hangs in the balance right now, depending on what happens with the Kincade fire or other fires in the next week.
You know, the other thing that struck me, Rebecca, when I was hearing city council members and politicians on radio shows over the weekend, is now they are all going after PG&E. I mean, we heard California Governor Gavin Newsom, you know, use the word greed. He talked about corporate malfeasance. I mean, he had very strong words for PG&E, and I thought about you because you would have the answer to this. Were these same politicians going after PG&E 5 or 10 years ago?
You know, I think we're seeing what we saw 20 years ago in the California energy crisis, which is basically people don't pay attention to utilities until there's a crisis, and then everybody jumps on the utility. I think at the point we're at right now, the blame game is non-constructive.
Mm.
The people running the company right now were not the ones who will put it in the position it's in. I mean, this is a whole new crew that's been brought in. And I think it's going to take all levels of government and the utility and Wall Street to figure out what the solution to this is. You know, as we've talked about, there is a proposal moving forward that would turn the utility into a publicly owned, a customer-owned company.
Right.
Basically do a public buyout. I would think that would have more legs this week, but who knows?
Wow.
I think everything's in flux right now.
Well, Rebecca's going to be with us until about 20 after. So if you have any questions for her, any comments about what's happening now, the changes you'd like to see, because this is not sustainable. I mean, Rebecca, we hear, especially in the national media, is this the new norm in California? I mean, this cannot be the new norm in California. So what are your thoughts? What questions do you have? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. What about that, Rebecca, this whole idea that this is our new norm?
I'm afraid I think it's going to be the new norm for the next couple of years, at least. I mean, it all depends on weather. And I'm sure everybody looked at the weather forecast this morning. I don't see any rain coming in the 10-day forecast. We're going to be in this terrible position we're in right now until we get some wet weather.
Wow. And we talked about this when you were on last time, just how this affects vulnerable people, the elderly, people with disabilities, people with children. And if you're talking many, many days without power, that's very bad news for people.
It's terrible. You know, I think when I was on last, I suggested people look at equipment they can purchase. There are little solar panel, solar-powered battery packs you can buy so that you could run certain things in your house, at least keep your phone and your computer up, have a few lights. So there are kind of fairly inexpensive workarounds that people can do. It doesn't obviously solve the larger problem, but it does make people more comfortable. And I think it gives you peace of mind, too, because who knows how many more outages we may have
right
before we get through the year, even.
Yeah. So those are just kind of mini solar chargers that you can use for various gadgets.
There's little solar chargers, but there also are, there's a company called Goal Zero that sells equipment where you have, I own some. You have a couple little panels you put up outside, and it'll charge a lithium-ion battery. So there are, you know, some ones that are slightly larger, like you would use maybe if you were off-grid camping or something. I think people should be looking at that.
Wow. Okay. And that's Goal, GOAL0.com, GoalZero.com. And today we are speaking with Rebecca Smith, an award-winning national energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She has been covering PG&E for many, many years, and we had her on recently talking about a major investigation looking at PG&E's business practices. We had a caller who couldn't stand on the line, wants to know what part of the state and federal government is overseeing these fires.
Well, the governor's declared a state of emergency, really, for the whole state now. And, of course, as you mentioned, there's a big fire that's going in Southern California in the L.A. area that's threatening Bel Air and Brentwood. Or I guess it was on the BBC report that preceded your talking, Rose. So, anyway, the whole state's in a state of emergency right now because of fire conditions. So I think the Office of Emergency Services and all aspects of the state government are involved in what's happening now. They have people at the PG&E Wildfire Center looking at what's happening. So everyone's involved in this right now.
Right. We have a message from Max who says, what would be the arguments against a public buyout? I would think there's no better acknowledgement that we're all in this together than to publicly take over the utility.
I think one argument one could use against it is that if you're buying a system that has had a lot of deferred maintenance, then you're taking on someone else's liability or taking on a liability someone else has created. And I also think it's very hard right now to know what the actual liabilities are. I mean, how do you assess risk in something like the fire conditions we're in now? Very hard to put a financial number around that. So I think you'd be challenged to figure out what the right price was to do a buyout.
Well, thank you for the question, Max, and we'll definitely do a show about that in the coming weeks. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Suzanne in Oakland. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show. Do we have Suzanne? I think we missed Suzanne. Suzanne wanted to ask about the greed of PG&E, and maybe she can call back, Suzanne, so we can get the rest of your question. But what about that? Rebecca, a lot of people are very angry at PG&E right now.
I personally, as you point out, Rose, I've been covering this company a long time. I think greed is the wrong word. I don't think it's greed. I think it's that when the company came out of bankruptcy in 2004, you remember its first bankruptcy, the priority then was on reestablishing the dividend and doing what Wall Street wanted. That's a little different than greed. I mean, utility executives are always well paid. That doesn't much matter. I think it's that they were trying to turn the company into something that would appeal to Wall Street. And in doing that, they were squeezing profits in ways they shouldn't have. So I think that's how you wind up with deferred maintenance. It's one of the ways you wind up with deferred maintenance.
And at the time, the Public Utilities Commission, or they still are, they're the body that is supposed to regulate PG&E.
They are, and I think we've seen a real failure of that body to properly regulate. I think they became fixated on other things like helping utilities achieve the renewable energy goals that the state had set and kept raising through the last 10 years. And there was a lot of emphasis on that and not on getting out there doing inspections. I mean, the PUC has actually relatively few field inspectors. So that got kind of, I think, de-emphasized to our detriment.
Rebecca, what are the questions you will be asking in the coming days?
Well, I want to know what's going to happen with the bankruptcy reorganization proposals, because, like I said, this is a real complication, this Kincaid fire. I always try to think ahead, you know, what could we be doing differently? What has to happen now to help people ride through these outages, you know, more comfortably? I don't know, but I think we're going to need some new methods, and I think more needs to be done to help particularly the vulnerable population.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely also do a show about that. Rebecca, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Rose.
Rebecca Smith is an award-winning national energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She has been covering PG&E for many, many years, and if you do a search, you can find the recent investigation she did about PG&E's business practices. And now I would like to welcome UC Berkeley Professor Kate O'Neill to the show. She's an environmental scientist, and she's the author of a new book called Waste, which takes a look at the global recycling crisis and global recycling policies. Hi, Professor O'Neill. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you. I should say that you are joining us from UC Berkeley, but the power is out there. So you're joining us via Skype?
I am. I've actually got power. We live on campus. I'm actually a resident faculty member. I live in the residence halls, but they kept the power on here, I think, partly because I don't think we want 5,000 18-year-olds without power for a few days. So we're fortunate we have power. Everything seems fine except for the air quality and the fact that we may or may not be teaching tomorrow.
Oh, right, because the school is closed today, right?
Closed today, yeah. And they said business as usual tomorrow. We're waiting on hearing about any changed conditions.
So, Kate, what do you make of this? We've been talking about the fires all morning, giving people updates. What do you make of what's happening right now? We're just talking to Rebecca, and she said, you know, what has changed is the fact that we're in a climate crisis, and of course, PG&E's business practices.
Yeah, it's a combination of a whole lot of things. I've been talking a lot with my students, though, about this new normal and what we might be able to expect every October. I think it's terrifying, and it is a result of a changing climate, but also sort of some messed up ways of managing the potential of threat of fire in the state. Although I will say that Cal Fire is doing an awesome job, has obviously really thought about how to plan for these events during the year, and I'm really glad that there's been no loss of life so far.
Right. Two people have been injured, but luckily no loss of life. And we've been giving shout-outs to the firefighters because they, in some cases, are working 36-hour shifts.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about them with the air quality, because the air quality is so bad, and when they take naps, they usually do it outside.
Yeah, that's not great.
Yeah. What about infrastructure? This is bringing up a lot of questions about where we are in California when it comes to infrastructure. I mean, just seeing all of these people stuck on 101 South, that's a major problem. Fires near bridges. There's just so much there.
Yeah, there is. And I'm looking at L.A. and all the people living in canyons that have only one road out. And that is also a problem. And again, I'm glad they started early, because there are very few ways out. I saw that 80 was closed a couple of times yesterday due to fires. So having backup routes would be seems to be fairly essential right now.
Today, we're speaking with UC Berkeley environmental scientist Professor Kate O'Neill, and she's out with a new book called Waste. So let's dive in and talk about waste. And I just say thank you for your patience, Kate, because we decided that we wanted to have an update on the fire since all of this is happening. So thank you for your patience. Your book, Waste, really looks at what is happening with recycling policies around the globe, how and what we recycle. And can you talk about just how I think about economic growth? We hear a lot about that the economy needs to grow, and so much of that is based on us buying stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. We have definitely a model going of increased consumption, of ongoing purchase of products, and often sort of policies, almost sort of business plans of a lot of companies to keep getting us to buy things by giving them a shelf life, quote unquote planned obsolescence, things like cell phones and computers lasting only a couple of years. So then we have to buy a new one, and we can't actually have access to the technology or even the instructions that we might need to repair those devices.
We had you on a couple of months ago after China decided that it would no longer accept recyclables from the United States. And a lot of people knew that they were accepting electronics, but I don't think that many people knew that China was accepting 40% of recyclable trash from the United States.
Yeah, that's correct. I think China's policy decision that went into effect, I think March 2018, was a real surprise to a lot of people. I mean, some of us have been following the story for a while, but I think even I had no idea of the extent to which we were sending plastic and paper to China for recycling. So it has really been a story that has kept reverberating ever since China closed its doors. And we're now seeing still crises in recycling here. We're also starting to see a lot more innovation, but we're also seeing, you know, further obstacles and challenges in terms of maybe shipping that to other countries. For example, in Southeast Asia, we're also seeing growing efforts at the international level to figure out how to regulate trade in plastics and other kinds of scrap.
And can you remind us, why did China decide to accept so much from the United States, so much waste?
China actually started really taking this scrap in, scrap or waste, depending on how you see it. It started taking it in the early 2000s in a large-scale way, and that steadily grew until about 2012, when it peaked but remained high. after that. Well, China was in a period of economic boom with growth rates, you know, as high as 15% annually. And that meant it needed to feed its growing manufacturing centers with materials, but did not produce enough virgin plastic or produce enough plastic scrap on its own. So it turned to recycling, to buying our scrap from us and using it in its own manufacturing and economic production.
And when they decided to stop, they said that too much of the shipping materials that they were receiving were contaminated with food and other junk, which made them impossible to recycle.
That's correct. Contaminated both by being dirty or being too mixed or containing a whole bunch of other stuff. So in effect, rather than being able to process them effectively to the extent that they did, they had to get rid of it, throw it away themselves.
And what were the other reasons?
I think there was a lot of other things going on. I think politically, the government in Beijing who made this decision were wanting to improve China's image overseas. It's not coincidental that they used the phrase "no more foreign garbage" when they made the announcement in summer 2017. And I think between that and also banning electronic waste imports a few years before, that's showing an effort to no longer be seen as the world's dumping grounds. You know, on the ground, China is certainly still facing a massive environmental crisis. So again, not importing the scrap looks like an important step in this battle. But the thing is, as far as I understand, China has actually simply replaced foreign scrap with domestic scrap, which is not necessarily of the same quality at all. So it'd be interesting. I haven't heard direct reports out of China or updates out of China, but that was the impression that we have right now.
And before we go to break, Professor O'Neill, this has been a major wake-up call for the United States, because it's really forcing people, all of us and cities and states, to look at our own practices here.
That's correct. I think that information news about this is filtered right down to street level. I mean, here in Berkeley, we're still trying to figure out what we can recycle or cannot. I'm constantly trying to keep up with that ever-growing, ever-evolving story. So it really has thrown people into disarray. I mean, most people I talk to are like, well, what's the point anymore of recycling altogether?
And what changes have you seen in the United States as a result of the change in China?
Changes really across the country. One of the things about the United States is that, unlike many other countries, it has no real federal policy about recycling. And so states and communities are really left to make their own policy. So in some cases, states and communities have simply stopped taking in plastic recycling in particular. In other states, they've raised prices. They've changed the combination of materials, the sorts of materials they'll take in. Changed where they're sending the materials, but often to landfill. But on the positive side, we're seeing a lot more efforts to increase reprocessing facilities. Materials reprocessing facilities that are called MRFs are trying to beef up their technology. There's some effort to bring in artificial intelligence, robots essentially, who can sort the garbage much faster than humans can and pick out the pieces that can be more easily recycled. So there's a lot of attention at that level, and also at the production and use of, especially of single-use consumer plastics, and trying to cut back the size of that particular waste stream.
Today we're speaking with Professor Kate O'Neill. She is a UC Berkeley environmental scientist and professor, and she's out with a new book called Waste. She writes about the complex global waste crisis and the business of producing, collecting, and disposing waste. A study published in the Anthropocene Review in 2017 estimated that the total of material output of collective human enterprises since the Industrial Revolution is at 30 trillion tons. We really need to reduce our waste. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Calls One Planet. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by UC Berkeley environmental science professor Kate O'Neill. She's out with a new book called Waste. She writes about the complex global waste crisis and the business of producing, collecting, and disposing waste. And if you have a question or a comment about recycling, every time we do a show about this, we get a huge response. So you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's hear from Lisa in Berkeley. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, first I want to thank you for always having an excellent show.
Thank you.
I guess my question is, what would be the possibility of actually either taxing corporations that utilize all this plastic for the plastic, or requiring that they have to reuse everything that they put out there?
Yeah, such a good point. And why, I mean, after all, Amazon and all these packaging companies, Professor O'Neill, mm-hmm. I just always wonder, the politicians have really dropped the ball on so much of this. You know, why isn't there a tax? I mean, Amazon doesn't even pay taxes. Why can't we tax them to deal with all of this packaging and waste?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I know that earlier this year in California, there was an effort to pass a circular economy bill and plastics bill that basically would have imposed extended producer responsibility on companies producing packaging, and that would have been a fairly effective way to actually make companies deal with it without imposing taxes, which of course would raise huge opposition. So extended responsibility is used a lot in Europe for all kinds of packaging, and it's pretty effective as long as it's backed up with some real regulations. Unfortunately, the bill didn't get through, mostly because they ran out of time. It was the end of the session, so there's some hope that it could be picked up in the new year. So fingers crossed on that one. But it is truly challenging, and I think Amazon is one of the most challenging parts of this whole equation. It's so huge and so, you know, exists all across the United States. So I think it's really hard to pin down and try and make its practices cleaner and use a whole lot less packaging.
Right. And I just wanted to make sure I had my facts right. So Amazon will not pay federal income tax for the second year in a row, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, even though it's worth almost $800 billion. Just to stick with this for a minute, Professor O'Neill, the New York Times ran a lengthy piece a couple of days ago called 1.5 million packages a day. The internet brings chaos to New York streets. So this is every day in New York City, there's more than 1.5 million packages delivered. What about that's so much waste, so much packaging?
Yeah, there's so many things that could be said about that number. But I think that's true. I think the amount of packaging is just overwhelming some systems. And of course, it's all different kinds of packaging. Cardboard boxes are the easiest type, but there've been things like Amazon Fresh, Amazon Pantry, the food delivery services use an inordinate amount of packing just to keep things fresh or keep things cool, that Amazon claims, oh yeah, we can take that back. But then they've moved to a delivery model that's more like Uber, with people with their own cars, and people who are driving their own cars and are asked to take the packaging back, they're like, we don't know what to do with that. Mm. It's just a business model that doesn't work in so many ways.
Wow. Well, thank you for the question, Lisa. Let's go to Carrie in Oakland. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, I hope I'm not duplicating the discussion, but I think that the producer responsibility tactic you were suggesting earlier is actually really important, because in order for the engineering solutions making the packaging not only less prevalent but also more reusable and more recyclable, if the producers themselves were held responsible for dealing with it, they would find ways to reduce the cost and make the stuff more reusable.
Yeah, I think that would be something that really should be pushed for. Again, we already have that in place for electronic waste. You know, you buy certain kinds of electronics, you pay a recycling fee. I think part of the issue with that, though, is accountability. What happens to the electronics once they're taken back? packaging may be a little bit more straightforward, as it has to be these days dealt with at home. But I do think that that's a good, what I think of as a point of intervention in this entire plastic supply chain. It's not the only one, but it is an important one.
Thank you for the call. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Today, we are speaking with Professor Kate O'Neill about her new book, Waste, which takes a look at global recycling centers and just the business of waste and this crisis that we're in. Since we were talking about China, what really strikes you about how China deals with its own waste? Because I just read that China's middle class is now bigger than the entire population of the United States. And a Costco just opened in China in August. And it's the same scenes that we sometimes see here, where there's just people are grabbing things and fighting over things. So how is China going to deal with all of this packaging and waste?
That's a very good question. I think that China has a lot of problems there. It's a lot of different ways and sort of contradictory ways that I think governments there, local governments, are dealing with it. We know already that there are huge issues with litter and piles of trash, especially the non-biodegradable plastic trash, some of which is sorted through by waste pickers and dealt with there, reprocessed and resold just simply at that informal level. China has a higher rate of incineration than we do. They have included waste to energy incinerators as part of their plans to combat greenhouse gas emissions. And then you have some sort of major measures that I think only a non-democratic government essentially could do. But in Shanghai right now, people living there are required to actually sort all of their garbage and put it into different containers, whether it be dry, wet waste, hazardous waste, or recyclables. And that is being enforced quite strongly with fines and with other kinds of measures of punishment, so that citizens are actually required to do that. It's first law of its kind, as far as I know, to be imposed upon or enacted in such a huge metropolis.
What about other countries, Professor O'Neill? Because in many cases, like Central America and South America, there are not good systems set up for trash. And then when you think about the people, through no fault of their own, you know, they don't have anywhere to put the trash. And then depending on where they're located, they see new trash come up on the beaches on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So these are major, major challenges.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that as we see these growing megacities, particularly in the global south, we are going to see ever-mounting trash issues that really are going to be very hard to deal with. In the west and the wealthier north, we're almost getting a handle on this. We're still generating a lot, as we've talked about already, but we have goals in place and practices in place, and also, you know, the mindset certainly in Europe in place to reduce these waste streams. In developing countries, no matter what, there's really just not the infrastructure to deal with this waste effectively. And there's moves to change this, and there are various international companies and even foundations working to provide infrastructure and investment for these, but we're waiting to see if the large international development agencies like the World Bank might actually step in. And there's some indication that the World Bank and other regional development banks might be starting to think about waste as part of their portfolio of issues.
Just a couple of days ago, The Intercept had a piece called River of Trash: How Plastic Pollution is Making Central American Communities Uninhabitable. Focusing on places like Guatemala, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen photos there. I've seen photos in Thailand of rivers and canals just clogged with trash, and it's a serious issue and would require a good deal of investment to clean up. And also a lot of that plastics will eventually, and that waste will eventually wind up in the oceans.
What about plastic? You write about this in your book. I mean, we've done a lot of shows about plastic being a major, major problem. What about recycling plastic in the United States? Because in some cities, they now say that you can recycle plastic bags, but there's some confusion about that.
Yes, plastic bags are definitely a problem. If you talk to the people who run the recycling facilities, they are very clear that if they're to be collected at all, they have to be collected separately and not put in the main recycling, because they will tangle up the machinery that they use. So I think that, no pun intended, is a bit of a mixed bag. There are things that can be done with plastic bags. There's things that can be done with almost all plastics. The question is it economically feasible? Is there a market for what is produced from recycling plastics? Where can it be used? And that is really something that a lot of people are thinking about, both domestically and internationally. One of the developments that I've seen are Chinese companies moving into the U.S. to reprocess plastics, and presumably to ship cleaned and prepared reprocessed scrap back to China itself, because they still need it. It'll meet China, rather than strictly stopping imports, imposed a very strict contamination standard on the plastics that would be imported. So if that can be met, then that's a market that would reopen. But it's a little early to tell if that's going to happen or not.
Today we are speaking with Professor Kate O'Neill, Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley, and her new book is called Waste, which details the complex global waste crisis. And if you have any questions or comments for Professor O'Neill, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What are your thoughts about this growing crisis of waste, and how do you deal with this? And what are your thoughts on government solutions? Or what would you like the government to do? We have an email from Pamela who says, I pick up my mail and Amazon packages at a local UPS store, which takes all the boxes, which are often 5 to 10 times the size needed for the item within, and plastic bags they're sent in and reuse them. And she says that she brings things home to reuse them. But that's another good point. You might buy something small and the box is much, much bigger than the item.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that rethinking all of those packaging sizes actually has so many advantages, not just less waste, but maybe they're easier to ship. You can ship them in smaller, in larger quantities in a single, I don't know, train or container that saves greenhouse gas emissions. There's all sorts of reasons why that packaging should not be as big as it is, not just waste. So that is really something people need to start targeting very seriously.
We have another email from David who says, 10 years ago, I would send and receive items in envelopes padded with shredded paper. When done, the envelopes went directly into recycling. Today, nearly all padded envelopes are made of Mylar with plastic bubble wrap fused to the inside. These go directly to the landfill. This is a huge step backwards.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that's partly plastics becoming so much cheaper than paper. They are lighter. There is that advantage, but I think it's partly that plastic is just virgin plastic is just so cheap. Most recently, is cheap because of the shale oil boom as a result of fracking operations around the country.
Mm. Well, you know, working at a radio station, we get a lot of books from publicists, and most of them come in the envelopes with the plastic. So I've been writing them saying, can you please just use cardboard? Because there's really no need for the envelopes with the plastic bubble.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And yeah. It's books. How fragile are they?
Right. Well, thank you for the email. Let's go next to a caller, Greg in Woodside. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I was going to ask if it's possible just to do legislation to restrict the types of plastics that can be used for disposable goods. Because, you know, they keep coming up with hybrids, and it's just, you know, just so many different varieties. If they restricted, you know, and limited the types of plastics that can be used, and those plastics are highly recyclable, I think that would go a long way. And then also adding a deposit, just like, you know, aluminum cans would add value so that consumers were, you know, trading those in for recycling.
Thank you. Professor O'Neill, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a number of thoughts on that topic. I think that with the 5-cent charge, I think that's been effective over the years. We have seen, though, most recently, Replanet, the company that ran most of the redemption facilities and centers around the state, suddenly closed its doors. And that that actually put a real restriction on the extent of redemption of bottles and cans and so on, and also in the course of it affected the livelihoods of many of the unhoused and other very poor people who were using that as a source of income. I mean, we may not think of it as very much, but it, it can make a significant difference. What was the other question was on, I'm just trying to remember.
Let's see, soda cans, aluminum.
Yes. Oh, sorry about that. Maybe if the caller can repeat that question.
I got the aluminum part. Did anyone get the second part of the question? All right. I am guilty of multitasking because we're getting so many phone calls right now. I'm sorry about that.
Yes.
If you can email me the second part of your question, and I will pay better attention when we get calls. Thank you for calling in, Greg. Let's go to Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. You know, we're talking about the producers and the companies and the government making some regulations. Hey, it's down to us. We're materialistic junkies. We're knee-jerk buy stuff, especially with stuff like Amazon Prime that encourages you by making all of the shipping be free. We've got to stop accumulating so much crap and doing it that way. You know, go to a brick-and-mortar store. You probably don't even need 90% of what you order. It's up to us. It's up to the public to stop promoting this by just buying all this stuff online all the time. And it's really our crisis. It's not something, I mean, it's about the companies also and the way they ship and everything. That's true. But we don't need to buy all the crap we buy, and we need to change our ways. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. What are your thoughts on this, Professor O'Neill?
I think this is something that comes up an awful lot when I talk about this to pretty much everybody. And I think, yes, we should be thinking more about what we do. There's people who talk a lot about the norm of thrift. This is actually comes up a lot when thinking about food waste, is that we're sort of brought up, certainly our grandparents were brought up with the idea of you must save things, you must be thrifty, and that norm has really weakened, although we still feel unsettled about it. That's what people have said. You know, we still kind of want to be that way. But I think we've also got a lot of pressures on us, including advertising pressures, including the fact that a lot of the stuff we buy will just deteriorate real fast. Another example of that is fast fashion, that you buy these clothes in very, you know, often and frequently because fashions change. The industry has got a very successful model of changing fashions quickly and manufacturing those clothes all over the world very quickly, shipping them, particularly teenagers and other folks buy them in vast quantities, wear them once, throw them out. And unlike clothing 10, 20 years ago, they really aren't so easily donated and resold as used clothes. So that's a big problem. And I actually did just remember the first part of Greg's question, which was about different kinds of plastics. And I think that we're trying for that, but we're still having some challenges. I can talk more about compostable plastics if you'd like.
Yes, but, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that's something the city of Berkeley is really working on right now, which is to replace single-use regular plastics with compostable plastics and make those available primarily on demand. And even here, we realize that there are some problems with that, in that compostable plastics that you might get as utensils are not as easily compostable as apple cores or orange peel and things we normally just throw in the composting bin. They require more time and special treatment to break down, and they are therefore more expensive to break down. There aren't that many plants that make them, and the really, really unfortunate thing is that often they are made with plastic compounds that I think are called PFAs that are actually can be toxic. So the quest for truly compostable plastics and also a company that can make the compostable plastics that we have, there basically are only one or two to make sure that they are the ones providing those utensils in the first place. So it is what you might think of as the holy grail of dealing with plastics, is to find something that is light, is cheap, you know, is something that can meat, or, you know, holds up, is will not dissolve on contact with hot fluids. All of those things are hard to find in one single replaceable material.
So basically, if your grocery store does have those compostable bags, you should still try to use less of them.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, just put the vegetables in the cart.
Right. Nope. All right. Well, thank you for that call, and thank you for remembering the first part of the question. Let's go next to Philip in Brisbane. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. Good morning. Thank you. Well, I just wanted to say, among many things, but in the interest of time, I will just say that I have found that you can recycle styrofoam. So if you're getting packages of all those little peanuts, they do not go in the trash in San Mateo County in San Bruno. They will take it and recycle it. And since it has toxic styrene, I think that's a good thing to do.
All right, thank you.
I guess
you.
That's what I have to say.
Okay, great. Well, we love tips. Thank you so much. Professor O'Neill, I was really struck by a number in the very beginning of your book. A study published in the Anthropocene Review estimated that the total of the material output of collective human enterprise since the Industrial Revolution is 30 trillion tons.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that is still with us today.
Yes, I that's one of those figures that's hard to visualize, but one of the ways that people thought about it is that it's essentially a geological layer, that it is a stratum in and of itself that is covering large chunks of the planet. And people often talk about it as a potential reservoir. It doesn't just include the plastics and so on, but it includes iron, steel, other materials that could potentially be mined one day as and when we may really need it. But it is a truly spectacular amount that we've produced over time.
And Professor O'Neill, I mean, what other major changes would you like to see, say, in the coming year? We have about a minute left.
Oh,
I know, it's big.
Yes, that is big. I think that we need a lot more thought about markets for recycled goods of all sorts, and to really remember that no matter what, all of these products, from plastics to clothes to cars to all kinds of electronic waste, they travel the globe. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out a way to make them travel the globe more cleanly, in a way that they won't pollute the communities they wind up in, and that they become a valuable source of economic activity. I think that part of that is to encourage what we think of as the right to repair. In other words, to make these goods cleaner, to make computers more make their parts more interchangeable, all of these great things that I think would really work effectively to reduce the amount of waste that we produce and increase incomes around the world from recycling.
Well, Professor O'Neill, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rose, for having me on.
Kate O'Neill is Professor of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley and the author of Waste. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.